here are monsters with razor-sharp claws that hand grenades and dynamite cannot stop. Nor searing fire and flame. Nor tons of crushing rocks. As mankind faces its last desperate chance.
Hi, this is Justin, and we just finished watching a Roger Corman triple bill that included Attack of the Crab People, X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes, and Rock All Night. And we'll be discussing these films, and today the people that watch them with me are Nate,
Emily,
and Jay
of HorrorSection.com. And
was it crab people or crab monsters?
Was it crab monsters? Yeah, probably crab
people.
Yeah, probably crab monsters.
Human-like eyes.
Yes, we'll get to that when we talk about them. Now, I pick these films because I've read a lot of books lately on Roger Corman, and my friend Duncan recently got me a new book. I don't have it in front of me right now. It's a big hardcover, great pictures, and it's an oral history of Roger Corman. And I'm like, you know what? I'm finally going to sit down and play some Roger Corman films. I mean, they're an hour long, so we could probably do three. But every time I would say, like, I want to play them, and I would tell Nate what films I'd play, he was like, no, don't play those ones. They're boring.
Yeah.
So I tried to pick ones that, while I haven't seen them, which is usually the way I like to do Laser Blast, is that I play films that I haven't seen so I can experience them with everyone. I decided to go with The Crab Monsters because I had heard people talk positive things about it. And what did you guys think as it went along, like when it played? What did you expect?
It's exactly what I expected. It's exactly like the, you know, 50s sci-fi, yeah. Roger Corman. If you've seen one of those Roger Corman monster movies, then you've kind of seen them all. But there's still, like, so much fun just to watch, like, all, like, the weird, like, goofy, like...
The monster design.
The monster design is always, like, fun to watch, especially when... Because they build it up so it's not, like, by the end you're like, ugh, I'm so tired of seeing this one shot of this monster. Mm-hmm. They slowly give you a little bit more and a little bit more of the monster until at the end you...
And as you pointed out, this crab monster has very drunken eyes. That's the first thing you say.
It is humanized, too. It's about crabs that have radiation poisoning, and they can talk telepathically with
and
people.
And grow giant. And they're
giant, yeah.
And their molecules aren't attached, so they can, like, separate and be electrocuted.
But for some reason, they have, like, human, like, hungover eyes.
As if they spent a really hard night.
Yeah.
Emily, as someone that is a monster connoisseur, what did you think of putting eyes on monsters like that? Like, you like monsters. What is, like, your favorite design, and how did that stack up to?
Oh, what is my favorite design? I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I like how the eyes gave the monster's personality. I think it maybe,
even though it made you goofy?
Well, it looks goofy, but I think it attracts the audience a little bit more, and you're like, oh, I can really get into these crabs, as dumb as they look. But, like, it made me want to see what else happened. And there was one really cool shot of the crab showing up in the...
Going over the hill.
Yeah, and if there were more shots like that, it would have been a little bit more exciting. But
it's funny because you actually said, you're like, oh, I like this shot. I can't see his dumb, stupid eye.
Yeah, because it was ridiculous. But I think it endeared me to the film a little bit more.
Well, I think that's something that has kept these movies being watched and experienced, is that they are endearing. And especially this one moves at a pretty fast pace. People are dying left and right.
Somebody loses their head like 4 minutes in.
Yeah. So that makes it an easy watch as opposed to some of the Universal monster pictures that were coming around this time, which would take like 40, 50 minutes before a monster showed up.
Yeah, there's something like warm and like kind of homey about watching these movies. Yeah. I mean, if you ever watched them when you were young, like on television or something.
Yeah, which brings us to, that was a question I wanted to ask to Jay, is that did you watch these movies? Like,
no, I have seen actually very little Corman films. Like the ones that he produced in like the 80s, but the ones that from that era... Hardly any of them.
Because I would associate those with like a Sunday morning viewing on some like, you know, TCM or something like that.
Before TCM existed.
Well, or even like CBC or like that's the stuff they throw on at like 11 o'clock at night.
I really gravitated towards it. There was a few ones like, you know, Thing from Another World and them, but majority of them I haven't seen. It's more like the stuff they were playing on TVs, which was like current stuff, like 80s stuff. Mm-hmm. And
you weren't a Midnight Creature Feature guy when it was playing. You were a little bit older than us, so that's why I'm just throwing this question.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would make sense that I was, but I wasn't. I was mainly like VHS and whatever was playing around like 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock at night.
And it's interesting that Roger Corman was still a part of that generation. Like, Roger Corman was still making movies up until, like, the 80s before he kind of dropped off the map.
Started their careers working for him with it, when now they're making movies.
Like, you knew who Roger Corman was probably when you're growing up, even if it wasn't for those. Yeah.
Even so, like, he transitioned, like, I mean, people, like, he won an honorary Oscar because he's been around for so long.
And he's started the careers of so many people.
And it's kind of sad because you can see, and Roger Corman was someone that, you know, if you read books and he talks about filmmaking, as a director, he never thought he was that good a director, even though that personally I think that he's better than, you know, he would quantify himself. Because we watched The Intruder and that movie's great.
The Intruder is incredible. And that was him. That was him, like, he was like, I'm going to try on this movie.
Is that the William Shatner one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great movie.
He was like, I'm going to try, and the movie made no money, which was the first thing. It was like a first-time thing for a Roger Corman movie, and he was like, fuck it.
Yeah, I just don't want to.
Like, I'm never going to give a movie, like, my
try, because it failed in it. And that was one that he definitely, I mean, we recorded a podcast about The Intruder.
Yeah.
You go to Laser Blast Film Society page, and you can probably find.
What we said about it.
No, I don't remember either, but.
Yeah. Chuffed about it,
it's a great movie.
That was a great double bill, that and Targets, which is like one of my favorite Peter Bogdanovich movies.
Anyway, other previous Laser Blast podcasts.
The only thing I'd add is the thing that I found most impressive, at least about the effects, was the scale. It was actually like a lot bigger than I thought that thing would be, like the actual, like when they're standing next to it, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I made jokes when it first.
The legs just sort of be held together with magnets so they could just sort of clip off, but.
There's something I always like it in monster movies when they don't just go with like the like this is a blown up picture of an animal like way.
Yeah.
When they actually like when these monsters look like they were built by people, I find them so much more fun.
The eyes were dopey, but I mean they were definitely the most striking part of the creature. Right?
Yeah. So, what's the name of the movie? Is it Burt I. Gordon, the one who would make like the giant?
The guy?
Yeah, the guy that would make all the giant movies and they would be blown up images of, like, you know, the ants are here! You trade that for a goofy looking crab monster.
Oh, any day, yeah. Like, they seem like the scripts were written and, like, at the last minute they were like, oh yeah, we have to make the monster! Kind of. And then they, like they thought first about what the monster should be and then made it later.
I think that this movie is helped a lot. Like, you would never call the script smart, but it moves at a nice clip by Charles B. Griffith, who wrote a bunch of other films, probably most famously Little Shop of Horrors. Anything else you'd like to add, Emily?
Well, speaking of the script, if there's so much focus on the monsters, why add that weird love triangle in the middle of it where, whatever, the only female character is, like, crazy
suddenly
about
proposing.
A scuba diver, and she's also engaged to this other scientist?
That was the thing about, I think, and also I think there's something endearing about when he was making movies at this time, that the screenwriter would just, like poop
be
out
peeling
screens,
pages
basically.
On the
yeah,
day.
Exactly. And it was so, like, it was all just formula, but it was, there's something romantic, at least in my eyes, about being, like, a 50s screenwriter, like, writing B-monster movies, and, like, writing a script in 3 days, and it's done. Work on the next one.
And I don't know the backstory too much about this movie, but I'm sure they shot it in 10 days or something.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That. Down by someone's ranch.
Is Little Shop of Horrors still the record for Roger Corman's, like,
small, the shortest movie?
The shortest
probably.
Yeah.
I mean, because then the second movie that we watch, which is The Man with X-Ray Eyes, I'm probably getting this title incorrect, too.
No, it's X,
the Man with the X-Ray Eyes.
Which there's just X when it came up on the screen, but the full title is that.
And Nate pointed out that Tim Burton, it's one of Tim Burton's favorite films and that he was going to remake it in the 90s. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, if you ever hear Tim Burton talk about, like, old monster movies, though, like, I know that he's, like, genuine and he feels genuine about this stuff, but he always feels like he's, like, above it. And, like, he talks about War of the Gargantuas and stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just I just don't like the guy, but I always feel like he's, like, yeah, I like that movie.
If you think of Ed Wood and when Bela Lugosi has to fight the giant octopus in the Tim Burton Ed Wood movie. Like, you can see the crabs from the first movie we watched, like, so much in that octopus. And so it's,
well,
it's obviously very inspirational.
Times, yeah, where it all looks like.
I mean, you could argue that he doesn't have that attitude with Ed Wood. Like,
no,
he's not.
It's true.
Fun.
That's I really think. Like, I don't see it in his movies as much as I just see it in. Even Mars Attacks feels like loving.
Yeah.
I just don't like the guy.
Oh, man, Tim Burton. I have to say, I have a letter here from Tim Burton. He's a big Laser Blast Film Society fan.
just wrote, I'm sorry you feel that way, Nate.
So, X... it was like a sad, smiley face written blood. It's all swirly. X, you know, this movie is one that was interesting to watch. I never really... one of the reasons I didn't watch it was that when people would pitch it to me or I would read about it, I'm like, this movie has no plot. Like, what is this movie about? And watching it, I found, well, not much. Yeah. Speaking of movies that feel like they're improvised as they're going along, this is definitely one where there's almost no consequences beyond like the big major points of the actions he takes. Like, there's not that much building action beyond the cumulative effect of the eye stuff that he takes.
Yeah. Not so much having to do with just this movie, but this movie's definitely, I think you did a good job at choosing three movies that are from very different areas of Roger Corman's filmmaking. One was like the monster movies that he was making.
And I would have picked
the last one was like the teenagers movie, but this was like this is an example of his like slightly larger budget, like where he was trying more,
like The Trip and Gas.
Exactly. Mostly because it's in color.
Yeah,
which is
widescreen,
which is the difference of the other ones. Yeah.
But and I would have played probably one of his Poe films.
Yeah,
but we've already watched one. We watched Mask of Red Death, so that's why I didn't pick that one. What did you think of it, Jay?
I liked it. It was kind of cool. Ray Milland was he in like a Hitchcock film or something? I know the name.
I think he's in something.
Yeah, the name is very familiar.
He's in I recognize him from Panic at Year Zero, which is like I think he was like a big Hollywood actor that like slowly
that started to
look
slump.
At us uninformed.
We need podcast. Peter or Chris Nash,
someone to have their phone out.
And I remember that's Peter. Yeah. I remember reading that. The thing that people hate the most about podcasts is people being like, wait, who is that actor? Is he in that movie? But that's what makes it feel real, as if you're really having a conversation with someone. I feel that magic is gone when all the answers are at people's fingertips.
Although I can imagine someone being like, I know the answer to that, being so angry, like, at the end of a podcast.
Yeah. Leave it in the comments, and then, you know, we'll make edits later.
Show notes.
George Lucas it.
Yeah. What did you think of this, Emily? I know you...
I was falling asleep towards the end, but...
It's not the most compelling of films.
No, it's not, but I thought it was really interesting, and I kept wanting to, like, piece together how he would actually see things in X-ray vision, because he could see people without their clothes on, but what about, like the part of their bodies that weren't clothed?
Can I just point out, it seemed a little unlikely that it would take 40 minutes for him to go around actually looking at naked women. Because that would be like the first thing that I would do. I'm not afraid to say if I had that power. Put the drops in and like...
I mean, I'll be the first one to admit that for, you know, the X-ray vision, when you imagine how it would be illustrated on screen, think of the cheapest way possible, and that's the way it's illustrated.
Well, honestly, at first it seems like they're trying.
Yeah.
Like, at first he does, like, fades, and then it fades into, like, the pen underneath, the shirt underneath, you're missing a button.
Yeah.
And then it just seems like he's, like, rainbow vision.
Yeah, rainbow. But I think this is also a film that is helped a lot by its ending, and I think that's probably a lot what people remember, especially if they saw it on television or on, like, a double bill for something. Because it is a very compelling ending, as Emily said. If you had seen it when you were a kid, that you would have been like...
I would have been absolutely terrified. But I have a terrifying, like, I'm afraid of eyeballs in general. Mm-hmm. And them popping out of people's skulls and whatnot. That doesn't
here
happen,
for the beginning where it's just an eyeball for like a minute.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah. That's exactly what I wanted to see.
Like hyperventilating.
I can't be here.
I guess there's not that much to say with X, the man with the X-ray.
The rainbow effect was basically just trying to illustrate that he had taken too much of it.
Yeah.
Could no longer
like
control it.
Yeah.
And then the third film that we watched was Rock and Roll All Night. A film that I was first become familiar with two reasons. One, because I read the when Robert Rodriguez made his second film, Road Racers, he was remaking a bunch of
there was a showcase. Was it Showcase or Showtime?
Showcase,
Showtime, I think. They funded a bunch of Samuel Z. Arkoff remakes, basically, where they would take the titles of old movies and then they would make remakes of, like, TV movie remakes of them, where they were giving them to directors like
John Milius,
Alan Arkish,
Joe Dante made one,
and they were given complete creative freedom, but they were
and
they were super low budget,
and no one remembers any of them except for Robert Rodriguez's,
because it was like his second movie and he still has like energy.
And Robert Rodriguez actually wrote a journal about making this movie that was published after Rebel Without a Crew. It's long out of print now,
a sequel to Rebel Without a Crew,
which is his diary of making the movie, and you can find it online. But he mentions that Quentin Tarantino was supposed to make a remake of Rock and Roll All Night.
Yeah, because what they are was they were all gonna be based off the titles, but they didn't necessarily actually have to do much with the actual movies that they were based off of. Like, Road Racers has nothing to do with the original Road Racers. It's about, like, racing.
But Rock and Roll All Night is a movie I can see easily Quentin Tarantino remaking, considering that it's mostly people standing still and talking to each other.
In a bar. It takes place in one location.
The closest thing I could think of, because for, like, a remake type thing, would be Albino Alligator. Did you ever see that?
Oh, no, I've never seen that. Who made that?
Might have been, like, the director is, like, also an actor. It's, like, Kevin Spacey or something like that. And it's all in a bar. There isn't as much music in it.
Which, the same sort of thing. The other film that, the other reason that I actually wanted to play this is because it stars Dick Miller. And Dick Miller didn't get a chance to star in that many films for Roger Corman. Principally, he is known as cameos, but he did star in A Bucket of Blood, which is great.
Yep.
If you haven't seen it, filled with, like, hipster, you know, jazz cat.
We were mentioning Beatniks. Yeah. We were mentioning, though, that, like, Dick Miller should have gotten so many more starring roles. Like,
It's a shame.
Only just, you know, the cameos that he'd always do in the 80s.
That guy.
Because Dick Miller, even in this movie, he plays like a tough guy that everyone consistently calls Shorty. And he's really angry for it. And there's not that much character development.
He's young, though. He has leading man looks. And, like,
and he's very, as I said, charismatic in the role.
His presence. Like, the more I see of, like, his younger roles, I think that I agree with you.
For anybody who doesn't know who Dick Miller is, we should also mention that he was in Man with X-Ray Eyes.
He was
in, like, almost every Roger Corman movie.
He was a Roger Corman stock player that then Joe Dante adopted and put into cameos in his
He originally showed up wanting to be a screenwriter, and then he, he's been in all of Joe Dante's movies since. But yeah, he wanted to be a screenwriter, and they were like, well, we don't need screenwriters, but we need Indians. And he played an Indian and a cowboy
in the same movie.
I think it, I don't remember the title.
Yeah, I don't remember the title.
But it's like one of Roger Corman's first.
And Dick Miller, like, didn't really get that chance, and he did just continue to play, like, bit roles in films.
Yeah, exactly. Other than a few chances here with...
There's a new documentary that's coming out. That guy.
Dick?
Yeah, something like that. And it's it'll feature Dick Miller's life story.
They're trying to get funding for it, right?
He's still alive right now, but supposedly, according to Joe Dante, and I heard this from 3 years ago, he just his mind isn't really there anymore, and he can't remember dialogue and stuff.
I did an interview with him where, like, his wife had to do most of the talking. Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
His cameo in The Hole is very minimal, I think, for that reason.
Joe Dante
He's like
film.
A pizza guy.
So about Rock and Roll All Night. First 30 minutes, not too hot. A lot of music. A lot of lame music.
Though it's nice and relaxing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a mood piece. It's setting the time.
What I said while we were watching it was that it's like being at a bar at 2 a.m. Nothing is really happening. The band is just kind of playing because they're neat to playing. I mean, Emily was looking at her watch a little bit as it was going on. Even though the movie's just an hour long.
All of a sudden, it just gets so exciting.
It does. Yeah, and it I does. Think that...
Weirdly. It's, like, weirdly compelling.
Maybe it's Charles B. Griffiths, who also wrote Attack of the Crab Monsters. He knew what he was doing. He's like, I want to make it boring, and people don't pay attention to this. And then, boom, we get them, and it becomes, like, basically a play.
Or maybe he just wrote the last half hour, and the first half hour is just them hanging out.
The screenplay, and he's like...
And he's like, this is going to be 40 minutes. Yeah. Let's get some bands in here.
Just fill it up with a couple of bands.
Yeah. And it's only an hour long.
Yeah, it's just an hour long. It feels a little bit longer, I think it's the perfect...
Not really, though. The same thing with the crab monster. It's like, very, like, homey. Like, watching this movie feels, even though there's nothing particularly compelling on, and it'd be an easy movie to fall asleep to. But, like, if you're in the right, like, awake mood, like, early in the morning or something.
It's funny because it's a movie that I think was a perfect environment to watch here, because if I had put it on while doing something else, that first 20 minutes I would have been like, this is boring, and I would have, like, watched it out of the corner of my eye when... It's definitely a movie that you have to sit and pay attention to.
Yeah, I'm always predisposed to, like, movies that take place in one or two locations, so it wasn't that hard to sell for me.
I mean, not only does it take place in just one location, once the plot is that some robbers come in and hold a bar hostage, the characters don't move out of their seats until the film ends, which is very interesting. Not really.
But I could really imagine, like, the Quentin Tarantino version.
Yeah.
We were saying, Justin said, starring Quentin Tarantino in the Dick Miller role. I was like, ugh, no, even better, it would star Dick Miller in the same role, but like about 40 years
40 years
older.
Later, like, here we go again! Yeah. But, like, I gotta, you know, give praise, or maybe not praise, but, you know, good job, Charles B. Griffiths, because the dialogue is like rat-tat-tat.
Yeah.
Good, yeah. So once it gets into that groove, it, like, goes until the end. And every character, you know, the caricatures, but they're working in a very, like, you know, poppy stereotype, and they know how to play with that to add like jokes and like moments. So everyone in the movie gets their own beat, which is very important. Which is
almost the same thing with Attack of the Crab People. All the different little characters who have their, like, one of them's German or French.
They all have impressive considering there's like, you know, 20 people.
But we knew all of them kind of, we sort of knew who all of them were.
They got attacked, got killed off screen.
Yeah, they're all dead. Like, they
very quickly. We pointed out when Attack of the Crab Monsters, when we were saying people monsters, started, is that like, oh, there's so many people. Oh, I guess they're just going to all die off screen. Or a giant claw will come out and grab them.
But it's weird, like, you watch something like The Thing from Another World, which also has, like, a large crew of people. Mm-hmm. I think it was kind of a regular thing in sci-fi movies at that time.
I mean, you can
In The Thing from Another World, they don't kill them all. They're still end up with, like, they kill up, like, four or five, and there's still, like, 25 people left, and they're like, we saved the day!
That all share the
minimal casualties.
So what would you consider your favorite film, Nate, out of the three that you watch, if you had to pick one to watch again or tell someone, and recommend it to someone?
Maybe Attack of the Crab Monsters is the most compelling.
Yeah.
But
I think that my favorite one was probably Rock and Roll All Night, just because it has its, like, it's rough charm.
It's accessible. Like, if you're going to tell somebody to watch it, like, I mean, you're not, it's going to be, it's not going to be hard to convince them to watch that movie, whereas, you know, something like Attack of the Crab Monsters. Watch it. It's good.
How about you, Jay? What do you think would be Attack of the Crab Monsters? That's the one that.
No, I agree with you. Walk All Night, because it's.
Emily, are you going to grab the attack? No one's going to go with X.
That is my choice.
Oh, it's X?
Well, yeah, because I like the weird visual effects. I like how, like, totally insane the character gets by the end. It's like this weird downward spiral of this being mad about science. And I think that is very helpful with, like, weird 50s B movies. Like, it's something that you want to see is a mad scientist actually going mad.
I think that X, while not being the most compelling of films, it's definitely one that can make an impact. And it's one movie that if you go and see, you'll remember that movie. You'll be like, that one was...
And it's also the only one of the three movies that we watched that really looks like... Well, not the only one, but it doesn't look like a low-budget movie. Like, it looks like a real movie.
I think all the movies that we watched all have merit.
Fun. I think it was really good choices, and I think we could have gone a lot worse with Roger Corman's there's a lot of really boring movies. His first, like, he started off just in it for the money and, like, just making movies out of sheer, like, I can make profit off of this. How fast can I make this? How cheap can I make this?
I mean, these films are probably area.
They are. But it's interesting seeing Roger Corman's, like, crew come together and, like, seeing Charles B. Griffith come on, who's a pretty talented screenwriter, even though he's written a couple. I mean...
Well, when you write so many screenplays so fast...
He's, like, a talented... He was good at what he was doing. Mm-hmm. It's interesting seeing those things come together and seeing Roger Corman actually start to make very interesting movies.
I mean, it's probably, like, a podcast for another day, but it's interesting to
Roger Corman,
and, like, what happened, especially where he is now, because, you know, he started in these low-budget movies, which were crappy, but now they're endearing, and then he moved on to, like, 80s and the VHS, and then, you know, all those things.
Which are also now endearing.
Yeah, but now, like, if you look at the films that he's making, they're not very endearing.
No, they're, like, Mega Shark type
stuff. Yeah, Mega Shark movies.
They're ugly.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, now. And but do you think those films, like...
In 20 years? I fucking hope not. Which is sad. Chris Nash is like, the film industry is gonna die!
I think that, if people don't know, Chris Nash is another podcaster who's not currently here today.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chris Nash.
I think that one of the problems about is that while Crab People is self-aware, there's that layer of charm over in its production. Mm-hmm. While the movies that are playing now, like Attack of the 60-Foot Cheerleader...
It's like they're not even trying anymore. And not in a way like before... Like, Roger Corman, even at his most, like, cheap in the 50s and stuff, when he was like, let's do this as fast as we can, was still trying to make a movie. These movies don't even feel like movies. They feel like things to be made into YouTube videos, like, later on.
You mean like Mega Shark or
Crocodile? Yeah, exactly. They seem like things that the trailer's going to... More people are going to see the trailer than the
actual
movie. And
I think that the self-awareness and the cheapness has, like, a different feel than it does from back then. What do you think, Jay? Do you think that there's been a degradation of, like, the work that he's been making? He's just following the trends and doing what needs to be done?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I think that they do, these movies, they do have merit, but more along like what you're saying, Nate, about like sort of the just YouTube generation of it. It's not, I can't imagine how many people are actually going to go seek out and watch the entire movie after just watching the trailer, but So I don't know. It also just seems like there's more of them. Like, it seems like there's an oversaturation of it.
Yeah.
Of, so, I mean,
watching Corman's World, a great documentary about Roger Corman, which I think we've probably all seen. But yeah. It's so sad.
That, like,
going back and forth from, like, we go back to, like, the history of, like, him being, you know, the person who created, like, B-movies and who made them, like, a thing.
And then you see him helping to edit.
So many people. And then you just see him filming Crocosaurus or something.
Mega Shark.
Yeah.
Sharktopus.
Like. Sharktopus, that's the one.
Yeah.
And just being, like... And being like, more blood, and he sits there like kind of sad, bored. Yeah.
I think that what these movies need to work is not, especially new ones, is a Charles B. Griffith. Yeah. That's the magic that these films need.
They need something
to bring back the endearment.
Yeah.
To make them endearing without self-aware or corny.
We need to get past that.
On the crabs. You need those to endear you to everything. Yeah.
Just we need to get past...
Googly eyes.
Emily hates eyeballs. We need to get past, though, like, the like, B-movies don't have to be, you know, bad, like, so bad it's good, laughable. Yeah. They can be endearing in other
and
ways.
Engaging.
In the way that I find most of those movies from, like, the 50s and 60s endearing.
Yeah.
Or from the 80s even endearing. I don't watch them because I'm like, I want to laugh at this movie's misery.
Yeah.
I don't know, which I feel like...
Like Sharknado.
It's like a... Yeah, exactly.
Like, you want to be involved in a film, even if it's low budget.
Yeah, exactly. No, I still want to... Yeah.
Dopey eyes on all the crabs.